Ever felt like a single moment could define the rest of your life? What if that moment was your worst mistake? Today, we're talking about redemption, resilience, and rebuilding. Our guest knows what it's like to lose everything and still find a way forward. If you've ever felt trapped by the weight of your past, stay tuned. This conversation is about healing, growth, and finding purpose again. And hey, before we dive into this episode, make sure to head over to driveonpodcast.com/subscribe, sign up for the mailing list, and get my top 5 favorite episodes sent straight to your inbox. Now, let's get into it. Mark, I want to welcome you to the show. I'm glad to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm grateful to you for having me on and for the work you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we kind of jump into everything, I always find it a little bit useful to kind of share a little bit about the guests and their background and stuff. Tell us a little bit about your story, particularly there's an incident in 2008 and how that became a turning point in your life.
Yeah, I always kind of start the story right there, Scott, because that really was a turning point, as you said. For me, that was at that time I was in my last semester of law school. I was living with a woman who I was planning to propose to marry that spring. So this was February of 2008. And I was about, it was my 25th birthday. And my girlfriend, Laura, who I lived with, had planned a birthday party for us. And at the end of the party, after drinking at the bars all night, I made the really foolish decision to try to drive us home drunk. And I flipped my car on the interstate, and my girlfriend Laura died in the accident that I caused. And so, in addition to the grief and shame and guilt that went along with losing this person that I loved, and being responsible for it, I was also facing the criminal justice consequences of that decision.
Right. And, you know, in those moments, like the grief is pretty significant, right? And then you have these charges that are being brought against you. And I know from going through grief and just the way your mind works, for me anyways, and I don't know if this was your case, I almost didn't care about anything else. It was, the grief was all encompassing as far as I was concerned. And the rest of it, I kind of just didn't care anymore. Like, I was in the military, lost my brother while we were serving in Afghanistan, and all the customs and courtesies and all the things that you do in the military, you know, saluting officers and yes, sir, you know, no, ma'am, you know, all these things, the way you talk to people, I didn't care anymore. It was just the grief. That's all I was really focused on. And, I gotta imagine, if I was in your shoes, it would be like, I'd be more focused on the grief than on anything else. But I don't know. What was your experience like?
No, you're exactly right. People sometimes will ask me, you know, how did you get through it? And the truth is, like, at first, not very well. And I want to say, Scott, just because you talked a little bit about your story, one, I thank you for your service, to our country. And also I'm really sorry to hear about your brother.
No, thank you.
Appreciate your sharing that with me. But yeah, I mean, at first I think people were surprised because one, this is an alcohol driven accident, right? I wasn't a person before that who tended to drink too much. I had been a bartender, like alcohol was a part of my life. I partied in college, like a lot of guys do. I partied less when I was in law school. But for the most part, I had like a pretty, you know, I was calming down by the time this happened. But I actually started drinking a lot more afterwards. I moved out of the house that Laura and I shared together and moved into the basement of my sister's home, which was in downtown Baltimore in a neighborhood that where there was a bar on every corner. And I didn't have a car. I totaled my car and wasn't sure if or when I wanted to drive again. And so I kind of just hung out in the neighborhood and drank a lot and felt pretty hopeless. I was really lucky in that. And that's strange to say, right, in a story like this, but Laura's family was really forgiving from the very first moment this happened. And there's a lot of layers of kind of complexity to what happened. Laura was planning to be our designated driver. And I don't say that to like skirt responsibility in any way, only to just kind of fill in some of the details for what her family's kind of perspective on this was. They knew about the plan for the evening. And I think they saw that I was a person who did in general try to take good care of their daughter and ourselves. And so they were very forgiving. And that made a big difference for me and at least being able to see some possibility that there was some goodness left in me.
Sure. And I gotta imagine, so we talked a little bit about, kind of your emotional state at this point, like what you are going through. But you brought up a good point with her family. What is she going through? Or sorry, what are they going through from the loss of their daughter? That, like, no, I don't care who you are, I don't think any parent should ever have to bury their child. And it's a difficult situation, but for them to be as forgiving as they were, that had to, kind of be, a positive sign in your eyes, anyways, right? With as far as, how do I move forward? If they can forgive you, then shoot, maybe you should be able to forgive yourself too, right? Was that one of the things that helped?
I think eventually, at first it was, I was in survival mode and I was grateful. I was really grateful for the forgiveness and also to have fellow travelers in this grief journey. These were the people who also loved Lara, and so to have been isolated from them at that time, I think would have been that much more difficult.
Yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely.
but and I want to say, their act of forgiveness is incredible, and nobody would ever blame them, as you said, as you mentioned, like, nobody would ever blame them to have felt completely differently about me, to have hated me, to have had so much anger,
Right.
to have never forgiven me. And so I just want to say, like, I point out their forgiveness because it was a blessing for me. And I think it can be really healing for people to forgive. And also, it's okay if you're a person who's been in a similar situation and that hasn't been a part of your experience to forgive. I think, forgiveness, though, looking at it as something that can be really good for the person who does the forgiving. I see that in Lara's family's experience, that was also part of what they needed to do.
And forgiveness, I'm going kind of a little bit on a detour here, but forgiveness is one of those things where it's kind of confusing, because I think a lot of times people think forgiveness is you have to be okay with the way things turned out, or the way things are, or whatever. But it's really not being okay with, like, a parent's never going to be okay that their child was,
That's right.
is dead, right? That's not being okay, but it's accepting it for what it is, and also realizing there's not anything you can do about it.
Yeah.
And you still can be sad, you still can be upset, you still can grieve the loss of that person, but at the same time, understanding, like, I have to let this go. I
Yeah.
can't change the situation. And I think that is more along the lines of what we're talking about as far as forgiveness, right?
Yeah, I think it's a decision to not live with anger in your
Yeah.
heart. And I want to say it's also something that sometimes you have to do over and over, right? You can forgive some, like, we can forgive somebody in our heart and really say, I want to forgive this person. I'm letting this go, and have moments where we don't feel that way in the future,
Yeah,
right? And we have to
right.
decide if we want to recommit to that. I think sometimes people think of forgiveness as this really final act. Like, when did you forgive this person? When did you, and sometimes we have to do it over and over. We have to
Yeah.
decide to continue to let stuff go. But I also think we kind of can get confused about accountability, justice,
Sure.
forgiveness, and reconciliation is the big one, right? Like, sometimes it's okay. I think it's different depending on the type of thing you're forgiving somebody for, but sometimes it's okay to forgive somebody and also know that it's not a good idea to reconcile with them. Like,
Yeah.
they're not a good person to have in your life.
Yeah, that's true too. Because you can forgive someone. Hey, this is the way that person is. I'm not going to change that. That they are the way they are. But I also know that maybe it's an abusive relationship or something like that, doesn't mean that you need to keep that person around, for
That's
your
right.
physical safety, for your mental well-being, all those kind of things. You may need to distance yourself from that person for those reasons, but you can still be okay with it in terms of I accept that that's who they are. I'm not
Yeah,
going to
you could
change
even
that,
wish for
right?
things to go well for them.
Yeah, for
Or
sure.
acknowledge in your heart that, you also make mistakes and that maybe theirs was worse or better than some that you've made, but, just acknowledge that people are fallible and, like them, you have screwed up too.
Yeah,
That can be part
absolutely.
of this spirit of forgiveness that we can just bring into the world.
Right. Now, all of these different emotions, the grief, the guilt, shame, all the things that you were kind of dealing with at this time, how do they kind of trigger your work that you're doing now, advocacy in criminal justice and addiction, work? How did that kind of trigger all of that in you?
Yeah, so it kind of came in phases, I would say. Initially after Laura died, like I said, I was really in survival mode. I was just trying to cope, and on some days that looked like frankly wishing that I was the one who was not alive, and at a certain point I started to be able to envision what a future might look like, and start thinking about what life could look like on the other side of this. Part of that for me was finding out what the criminal justice consequences of my actions were going to be. Because initially, in addition to the grief and everything, I really didn't know. I knew that the charges that I was facing could carry anywhere from 0 to 15 years in prison, which is, it's a huge diff to a guy who's 25 years old, especially. This is either a big chunk of life, or potentially, consequences that were not really severe or in my mind particularly in alignment with what I'd done.
Right.
And so I was eventually charged, and I found out that the prosecution was going to agree to a plea agreement that was going to cap my sentence at about 18 months. And in Maryland, where I live, for a first offense of this nature, that seems to be kind of like a normal sentence, is around 1.5 years. It's actually very low compared to a lot of the country. And
Sure.
I don't say that as like a good thing or a bad thing, but just to give people some details. And I wound up getting sentenced to only a few months, which meant I was going to serve about two of those months in jail. And a lot of that was through the intervention of Lara's family with the court and with the prosecution. And I think having seeing that there was at least a time after which I would be in control of trying to figure out what the future looked like was really, that was a time where I honestly sat in jail and really thought a lot about what would it mean to make this more meaningful, or and to have my life be worthwhile, recognizing that I survived this thing that I very much could not have, and that I wanted to also honor Lara's memory by doing something good with my life. And I got out of jail, and like a lot of people, I found out that it's really, really hard to find work with a criminal record. Some guys had said that to me while I was locked up, and I figured, I have a law degree. I worked for a congressman when I was in law school. I worked at the US Tax Court. I'd had bosses who could open doors for me and things, and I thought, this won't be a big issue for me. There's a lot of other stuff to deal with, but work won't be a big deal. And it turned out that it was. Nobody wanted to even give me an interview. But I did eventually find work helping other guys who were coming home from prison to get jobs.
Okay.
And that was my first entry into kind of the criminal justice work that I started doing. But I had no clue what I was doing. Like I said, I could barely find myself a job. I needed to figure out, like, well, what could I do to support these guys?
And it's kind of crazy how the these things work, right? And you're a smart guy. Obviously, you went to law school, and you are capable of doing these things. You worked for congressman, and you've had some pretty good success as far as that goes, career wise. But not everybody has the same, head on their shoulders, right? And a lot of times there are people who are in prison for theft and other, selling drugs or, other crimes like that, where hey, that might be their only option after getting out of prison, because they don't know really how to do anything else, and no one's hiring them to do something else. And so Well, there it seems like just going to perpetuate that cycle. I know I'm kind of getting a little bit off track here, based on what we're talking about, but if it's hard for someone like you who has a law degree and all these things in your background, that it's hard for you to find work. How hard is it for someone who doesn't have any of that? I guess is where I'm trying to get with that. And that I gotta imagine is part of the reason why you're doing what you're doing as far as the criminal justice reforms and things like that too, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what I saw was, I think a lot of people wind up after maybe having an experience in the criminal justice system, folks who wind up working in the field I do after that, a lot of times, it's driven by their own exposure to injustice of, and they're, they were treated unfairly in some way or found the experience harmful or whatever. And the truth is, I was treated more than fairly by the criminal justice system. But what I saw was exactly what you're describing. A lot of folks who had other issues going on, whether it was addiction, trauma, no histories of employment, low education, all these barriers in their way, and a system that seemed to be making it worse. And so, yeah, I wound up working in the public policy field for quite a while, trying to make it better for people when they were coming home. And what that meant for me was, how do we create programs that help people, and how do we get some of the legal barriers out of their way? Because I have a really firm sense of fairness, and like I don't mind at all. And I think people should be held accountable when they mess up. I think a big problem with our system that a lot of people aren't aware of is that once you have that record, there's actually 40,000 laws and regulations that limit your opportunities in employment, education, where you can live. So it's like a whole nother legal system that you wind up having to figure out how to navigate. And to me, that doesn't make a lot of sense once people have done their time or paid their debt, that we keep people trapped in that way.
Yeah, that's another. I think we could probably go down a whole nother
There's a whole nother episode.
a whole nother episode with all those types of things that could hinder people from making that re-entry back into society after their time in prison. But you seem to overcome some of this stuff. I mean, you're now working to help other folks. And talk to us a little bit about trauma-informed,
Yeah, so no,
that initiative.
I appreciate your saying that. Things in my life are going really well, and I feel really blessed to be able to give back in a lot of ways. And I actually what happened was that in a number of roles, I started seeing people doing this criminal justice work, this work around addiction or trauma, and a lot of these systems. And a not insignificant number of them, like me, came into their work because of personal experiences that were really painful. Whether they were incarcerated or a loved one was, they'd experienced addiction or trauma or walked with a loved one through these experiences, lost loved ones to overdose. And my background was in public policy, but I wanted to understand what does social science say about this? Why is it that some people seem to grow in ways that benefit all of us after these painful experiences? And I came and just doing kind of, the Google thing, I learned about this concept called post-traumatic growth. And in reading about it, I really, I could identify with a lot of what I was reading in terms of not just like the painful aspects of what people go through after a traumatic experience, but also some of these hopeful components of the ways that people change, in positive ways that I didn't hear a lot about before that. And I think our culture doesn't do a really good job of talking about. And so I started trauma informed really without an exact idea of how I would do this, but with the goal of just trying to rebalance the way that organizations and people think and respond to trauma so that we're both, trying to help people heal and making sure that we're not making things worse. And also recognizing that a lot of people come out stronger, more resilient, and with a deep sense of meaning after they've been through some shit.
And I think that's important too, is having that sense of meaning, sense of purpose. What am I going to do with my life now that I'm, on this other side of whatever the trauma happened to be? It could have been, losing someone who's close to you. It could have been, any number of different things, right? But I think we all are the sum of all of the experiences that we've had in our lives from the time we were born all the way through to this present moment, good and bad. And I say the sum because, bad you might think as like a negative and it subtracts, but no, really it adds to who you are. It's adding to that personality, that character, the type of person that you are. It may not be necessarily a good thing unless you're using that for a growth purpose, like you were talking about post-traumatic growth, where you discover more about yourself, who you are, and how you can, make better changes for not just yourself, but the world around you, right?
And that was really, so that was the lens that I came at this with, is why and how do people, become like more altruistic, I think is the way like they decide that they're going to give back in some way. And actually what I found out is that that was the lens that I came at it with, but it turns out that people grow and change in positive ways in a whole bunch of different areas. And only one of which is that sometimes they find ways that they want to give back. And you touched on a few of them there, in the way you were describing this, that, people want having more appreciation of life, getting a sense that, they want to slow down and appreciate beauty more, or the good things in their life, feeling more connected to others. And that happens in a couple of ways. One is, they see who was there and how important it was to have support from people in their circle. So they may feel more, people feel more connected because of the social support they receive. And then on the other side, they have this deeper kind of insight into what it means to suffer, and people develop greater empathy. And so a lot of folks wind up reporting that they're able to connect more deeply with others. A lot of folks find new possibilities in their life, so they decide they want to try new things. Sometimes this altruistic, like, I'm going to go do something good for the world, kind of falls in this new possibilities category. But it could be, I always wanted to travel and I never did, but now I realize like time is short. I'm going to go do this. So there's a people kind of reevaluate what they want to do with the future. And then a lot of folks experience positive spiritual changes. So sometimes that might look like reconnecting with the faith or developing a new faith. So it can be religious in that sense. Other folks, it maybe is more kind of existential, thinking about what is their place in the universe and things like that. And then for others, it may be more kind of like the Eastern sense of spirituality, where they're connecting more with meditation and things like that. But there's like a whole bunch of ways that people do well after trauma. And I think for veterans, right, I think a lot of what we know about trauma actually comes from the area of especially combat veterans, and concepts around PTSD grew up in that world. And I think the same thing there, there's some good work happening that actually these concepts of post-traumatic growth, also a lot of it originates in the military and veteran research around these communities. And I think the same thing applies here, that our culture has really gotten a very good understanding of the harmful ways that trauma affects people, veterans, people who've experienced a lot of other kinds of trauma. We kind of have like this cultural sense of what that looks like, even if it's a little, maybe a little skewed. But very little, like we, very little sense that like there's actually all these wonderful ways that people change, because we don't want to talk about it that way, because, I think there's a difficulty talking about it that way for a lot of reasons, and a lot of it just comes down to like we don't want to seem callous and not acknowledging the painful side, and so then we like, but then we don't give the person credit for the positive side because we feel uncomfortable talking about it.
Yeah, I get that too. But I mean, a lot of great things that we have in our society come from the military. Look at, go all the way back to, Jeeps. They came from, military. That was a
That's right.
military, tool. GPS that we have in our vehicles. Why not mental health care as well, right?
That's right.
That's another thing that just because of how many veterans or service members who have experienced trauma, especially over the last 20-ish years, When we were at war, I mean, we still have people, overseas serving. I don't want to take away from that and make it sound like I'm forgetting about those folks or anything like that. But, we have had so many people in that long time period who experienced traumatic events. War is hell is not just a catchy, slogan or anything. It's hell. There's terrible things that you see and have to do and all that kind of stuff while serving in combat. And so we got to take care of these people. And so we start to learn, okay, what's working, what's not working, and let's do more of the things that are working and less of the things that are not working. And that's where a lot of this comes in. But veterans and soldiers and service members, that we're not the only ones. We're not unique in the fact that we've experienced trauma. Anybody can experience trauma. As a matter of fact, most people do experience some sort of trauma in their lives, and it's just a matter of how do you handle it? How do you deal with it? And, some people maybe have that toolkit already built into them because they, from their upbringing, maybe they learn coping strategies along the way, and they seem to be a little bit more resilient. But other people might need some help along the way as well. And so we have developed some tools to help teach people how to be more resilient and experience that post-traumatic growth where they do something positive after that traumatic event. And so tell us a little, about trauma informed, and are there specific types of trauma that you guys focus on and the types of work that you guys do?
Yeah, so I would tell you a little tiny bit more of the story because it'll help me answer the question.
Sure.
So I started trauma informed, and the first thing, I'll say I thought this post-traumatic growth stuff, like, everybody needs this. And so I'll say my idea was I'm gonna do this for everybody everywhere in the world. They all need to know about this. I'm the guy who now knows about it. Well, of course that's not true. Lots of people already knew about it. Like you're saying, there's lots of work already happening. I was the new guy. And so I came to this thinking, like, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna figure out how to, like, teach people about this in every field. And kind of my attitude was very agnostic about, like, the type of trauma that people might be experiencing, the type of systems I was working in. But the truth was, like, all of my work up to that point had been in the addiction and criminal justice fields. And so it made sense to at least start in the addiction space. So we got a contract with this, I'm in Maryland. We got a contract with the state to develop this trauma-informed care training for addiction providers that was, delivered over the course of six sessions, six, like, 2-hour sessions. And it went really well. And there's already a lot of content around trauma-informed care that's already out there. So we were able to kind of pull from some of that and, some of what I'd learned about post-traumatic growth. But the truth was, like, I really didn't know what I was doing. And the training went well, and people appreciated it, but I didn't really feel like people walked away with, like, an understanding, like, deep in their soul of what this stuff really meant and what they could do to change it. And I didn't really know how to change minds as much as I felt like I needed to make this work. So I went back to school, and you mentioned, like, good stuff coming out of the military. So I went to I went back to school at the Penn Positive Psychology Center, which actually developed the Penn Resilience Program, which is what all US military service members now receive as the resilience training.
Okay.
And so I get into this program and really have this idea that I'm thinking about, well, what happens to people after trauma? How do we help people after trauma? And through learning from the folks who developed the Penn Resilience Program, what I and my own research, what I found is that the ingredients for before and after trauma, to be resilient before trauma and be prepared for trauma, the ingredients for being resilient are pretty damn close to the same ingredients that we want in place after trauma for people to grow. Okay, is it? And maybe it sounds silly to say it out loud, but, like, that's not always true that when things that make common sense, that they also, make factual sense, or, like, research supports it or whatever.
Sure.
So what I found was, like, there are certain factors that seem to help people prepare for trauma. As you're mentioning, like, how do some people come with, like, a baseline, but we can also teach people to develop these resilience skills. And then what do people need in place after trauma, and how can organizations be prepared to sort of just nudge people in the direction of doing better. And so that's what I've been incorporating into trauma informed since then. And I know this is kind of a long-winded answer, but to get kind of to the point, what we do now is we actually train human services organizations, mostly addiction providers, in trauma-informed care, but incorporating all of this that we've learned around, like, how do you not just engage with people in a way that doesn't make things worse, but actually start drawing their attention to the good things about themselves and their environment and the potential in the future and their strengths, starting to draw some their attention to more of that stuff, just in like everyday conversations, but also in treating folks. And that's what we're doing now. We did about a dozen organizations last year that we worked with. So it's mostly just me and consultants I bring on for the when we deliver the training. We're hoping to do about twice that this year, and to keep reaching out where we can. And you know, we find in the systems that we work in, especially you know the addiction treatment system is especially like this. Folks are coming into it with a lot of different histories, right? Whether it's military service, trauma in the community, crime victimization. And so a lot of what we talk about are letting people reflect on those experiences. You know, I think people develop communities with others who've been through similar types of trauma. So it can be good to have people connect over similar experiences in that way. But the stuff that we're doing works for folks pretty much across the board, no matter what the kind of hardship in the past is. But one more important aspect of this is we're not treating trauma. If people need treatment for PTSD, that's a different kind of care than we're trying to help folks deliver.
So help me and maybe some of the listeners as well. So if we're dealing with something like a PTSD or some sort of trauma or we that we've had in our lives, how is it that like I'm trying to think how I'm going to phrase this. Like where do you guys come in that time period? This is I'm just trying to wrap my head around like where you guys fit into the equation.
So I should start this answer by saying we don't, through trauma informed, we don't work directly with trauma survivors.
Sure.
We're working with organizations that are working directly with folks who may or may not have survived trauma
Got it.
and trying to give them some tools so that they're kind of prepared for the reality that a lot of the folks that they're working with have had these experiences.
Got it. Okay.
Does that
So
make sense?
yeah, it does now. Yeah. And I think you said that I might have just missed it as you were saying it, so I apologize for that.
No, I
But
think I don't articulate it very clearly. I think your question was a good one, Scott.
no, I don't think my question was articulate. Somehow we came to a conclusion at the end of this, but I don't think I said my question all that well either. But
But
so
let me talk a little bit about how this happens in people's minds and
yeah.
then like why people change.
Okay.
If that would be, I think that
Yeah,
might help.
that would be helpful. Yeah.
And then I think that leads into kind of the explanation of what we try to teach professionals to do in their interactions with people. So we think of trauma, and there's, I don't want to call it small T trauma because this is like this stuff is painful and highly distressing. But there's like the smaller T trauma, I would say, where we're not talking about PTSD.
Okay.
But these kinds of changes can also occur in folks who are experiencing PTSD or have experienced PTSD. It's harder to get there, especially with untreated PTSD.
Okay.
And so the first thing that I say when I, because I also do some coaching with folks, is that what I do is not therapy and it cannot be treatment for PTSD. And if that's what folks need, you got to do that first. You got
Sure.
to do that part first. But when people experience a traumatic experience, the part that I'm really interested in is how this changes their ways of thinking. So we all come in to all of our experiences with what's called an assumptive world. So we have these like basic ideas. We may never have even had like articulated them to ourselves, but we have this basic idea of what the world's like. You know, bad things happen, but I'm generally safe. If you do the right thing, good things happen. Life is generally fair. Whatever these kind of preconceived notions we walk through the world with are. And the experience we have really, you know, shatters those assumptions. We find out, you know, even when I do the right thing, bad things can happen. Or, you know, I thought that, you know, I'm a good person and good people don't harm others. And I, you know, how do I rectify those two beliefs about myself? And for a long time, the way I did it was to conclude that I'm not a good person, right? I had to rebuild a new assumptive world, and my assumption had to change that I was a good person, because otherwise I had to believe that good people could kill others, right? And or something. I had to come up with a new way of looking at the world, which, you know, over time, I will say, over time, I've come to understand gray areas a little better. But so in the course of kind of rebuilding this understanding of the world, people, you know, may actually come to see the world a little bit more negatively, which I think sometimes surprises people when we talk about post-traumatic growth. So they may see the world as a little bit less safe, a little bit less fair. But the growth part of this is they also appraise themselves to be better prepared to deal with it. So they feel stronger and better prepared, even though maybe they see the world as a little bit less safe and a little bit less fair. They don't see people as there to support them in the same ways, or whatever these changes might be. And they also have this existential reevaluation where they start deciding that, you know, I'm more grateful for things in my life, or I want to try new things. There's all those different ways that people grow that we talked about. But part of this is all this rumination, right? When we're going through something that's really painful, we've all had the experience, whether it's a big T trauma or maybe a low T trauma or whatever, of having thoughts that just seem to like overwhelm us, right? Or thoughts that we wish would go away that intrude on our thinking. We call this intrusive rumination. It's when we have this kind of invasive thinking that we can't control. And over time, people usually are able to kind of shift into a more deliberate rumination where we actually get to decide, hey, I'm going to reflect a little bit on what this experience meant for me. But a lot of the distress is in that rumination and the reliving of the painful experience. So traditionally, what trauma-informed care has taught folks to do, so there's people who are treating trauma, right? If you're a psychologist or a social worker, you might be treating trauma. And there's different ways that you'll have been trained to intervene to actually help people heal from the trauma, right? But if you're a doctor or an addiction treatment provider or a homeless service provider, or you're doing some kind of service for veterans, there's a very good chance that you're providing services to a lot of folks who have experienced trauma, whether you're trying to treat their trauma or not. So what we try to do through trauma-informed care is prepare people to anticipate that folks may have experienced trauma, that there can be some like behavioral outcomes that come with that, right? People may be a little less trusting. They may be a little bit quicker to anger. And there's some things that may come up in service that they can be prepared for. But there's also some behaviors that they can do to make people feel more safe and comfortable, to show up as trustworthy and reliable, because a feeling that you can't count on people sometimes comes with trauma. We want to give people, we want to empower people and give them choice in the way that they receive services. And we don't say, hey, here's where you can go for housing services and here's your only option. We want to help people explore options, because a feeling that we no longer have control is often a part of trauma. All right, so there's all these principles that we teach people about how to not make trauma worse and how to help them heal in this kind of relationship where we're providing some kind of service. And that's awesome. So that's where we started. We wanted to do that, help people not make things worse, and maybe like just help people nudge along towards healing within these relationships. But there's a whole side that's missing from this, which is that you can actually start drawing people's attention to the ways that they grew and got stronger, right? The great things about themselves, all the strength that they had to show up with. A lot of times, the message we send to people is, you know, in an empathetic way, I see how you've been hurt. You know, you've been damaged and I care about you. Right. But the message is, you've been damaged and I see that you've been hurt. And we forget to say, wow, it's incredible that you got through that. That tells me that you're this, this, and this. these good things about you, that you're resilient, that you're spiritual, whatever it is that we see in that person. We want to teach people to draw attention to those good things. And then also help them to just nudge conversations into a hopeful disposition towards the future. Because those are the two things that I see in the research. Kind of, if you could break it down into two ingredients for people, it's connecting. So they need social support and connections with others. And it's an optimistic outlook for the future. Not unrealistic, right? It's not, I think I'm going to win the lottery in a couple of weeks and everything's going to be better. But it's, hey, if I stick in treatment and do the things I said I'm going to do, I can rebuild a life that I enjoy. I can get some things that I want out of life, and things
Right.
can get better. And that, to me, is the key ingredient in almost any kind of progress or growth we can do, is that we see a better future, and we see that our actions can contribute to it.
Yeah, and I think that's a key piece, because if you don't see that the future could possibly be any better than what you're experiencing right now, that light at the tunnel doesn't even exist. It's hard to be like, okay, well, I'm going to put in the work to move forward, because, what's the point? If it's never going to get better, it's, if anything, it's only going to get worse. It's like, well, then why bother? And that kind of mindset is, what a lot of times people end up with. And, to your point, that's not true. It will get better. There will be better days. Yeah, sometimes you got to put some work in to get there. But it'll get better. And if you don't believe that, sometimes it may even become a self-fulfilling prophecy, where you just don't believe it, and it's like, okay, well, then you make a bad decision. Well, that just reinforces the belief that it's not going to get better, because that bad decision led to a bad outcome. And it's like, well, see, it's not going to get better, right? And so, with those positive reinforcements, the people who are, saying, hey, look, man, you've been through hell and back, and you're still standing. Most people would have crumbled under this, and look at you're still here. It's like, okay, well, maybe I do have a little more fight left in me, right? And that kind of mentality, I think, is what you're getting at, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's really just to spell out kind of the ingredients as I see them in this, is like drawing attention to the positive aspects of the person, right? So you want to make sure that they're spending more time aware of what's good about themselves. Drawing their attention to the good people in their lives. So even if, for a lot of people that in who are getting services from the organizations I work with, the good person in their life might be that person delivering the services. A lot of folks don't have a big support network.
Sure.
But for other folks, it's really drawing their attention to the fact that they do have people who care about them and want things to go well for them. And then it's drawing positive attention to the future. What's possible in the future? What are the ways that things could be better, and identifying a pathway there. And so the first thing I do when I start with coaching clients is actually just like really small stuff to help them feel a little bit better, because it actually primes the brain for this sense of agency that like I can do something
Yeah.
and things can get better, right? So you think when you read like kind of self-help stuff around goal setting, it's like setting these small wins so you can get some momentum. Some self-help stuff is not like super well researched, but like some things are, and that getting those small wins along the way is really a great thing to do.
Yeah, I think the small wins, when you think about it, like, yeah, everybody looks at the people who seem like an overnight success, and like, oh my gosh, I wish I could be like that. But in reality, there's a lot of small wins along the way, that person experienced, and also some setbacks. They had some setbacks along the way too, in whatever their path to success, whatever success means for that person. It could be financial, it could be, relationships, it could be whatever it is that you're seeing as successful in that person. There were probably some setbacks. They weren't necessarily an overnight success. You're just becoming aware of their success overnight,
That's
and
right.
that's why it seems that way. But they had a lot of small little victories along the way, and that helps build confidence and helps them get to this point where they are eventually they're doing better, and they're looking back down the mountain and they're like, oh my gosh, I came all this way, and it was all it took was one step at a time, right? And it's the saying of how do you eat an elephant, and it's one bite at a time, right? And so like that's a big task in front of you, but you got to take it one step at a time. And sometimes those little victories, that's one step, and that's exactly what you need. And well, that may even be more than one step, because those little victories probably had a lot of sub steps, within them. And so, that may be, a whole mile on that journey, that you're going on. So, celebrate those little things too. I think it's important to remind ourselves of that. I have to do that to myself as well. I mean, good things happen, and sometimes I just kind of write them off as, well, it's a thing that happened, right? But celebrate those things. Why not? They're good. They happen. And if you're going to spend more time dwelling on the negative things that have happened, then that's going to reinforce in your head that everything's bad, everything's negative. There's all that kind of stuff. And so,
Scott, and it's not only that, because you don't even have to intentionally dwell on the negative. We have this really great adaptation. Well, when we were living in the wild, we had this really great adaptation called negativity bias, which is that our brains are really good at remembering things that go wrong, things that are threatening and scary and painful, because that's how our brain prepared us to predict future risks, right? The brain's first job was to keep us alive. And so if we don't do anything, everything else being equal, our brain is going to be drawn to that negative information and things that make us down and worried. And so we actually, the only way to balance this is to intentionally draw our attention. And over time, you can make this a habit. So you can make your brain want to do this, but we have to intentionally draw our attention to good things in our lives, or we will have a tendency to dwell on the negative because we're biologically programmed to do it.
And our brain, as great as it may be at keeping us alive, it could be a pain in
That's a, yeah, that's exactly
the
right. There's a cool little exercise that some people really love. There's a ton of research behind it. I've done it at different periods of my life. I'll say I'm not doing it right now, but I found it really beneficial at different times. It's called the three blessings exercise, or three good things. Some people feel like the three blessings feels more religious than they are comfortable with, but either way, it's like at the end of the day, you just jot down three things you're grateful for from the day. And some days it might be really great, big things like I saw my child smile, or my child walked for the first time or something. And other days it might be like, the sun was shining. You had a lousy day, but you could figure out like the sun came out for a little while. I'm having a peaceful end to the day, whatever it is. And there's an extra little ingredient to this is try to figure out what about you, the people in your world, or the things in your life made that possible, right? So even with the sunshine today, well, I wouldn't have known that if I didn't at least go outside. Whatever it is. So something about you, because that's again drawing your attention to the ways that your actions result in good things. And it's a great exercise that if folks try for a few weeks, the research shows a lot of people feel just a lot better about themselves after this.
So, I mean, just as a takeaway for the listeners, I know we're kind of getting close on time here, so I'm gonna try to speed this up a little bit, but just a good takeaway is try that. At the end of the day, what are three things that you could be grateful for, or blessed, whatever word you want to put on it. Find three things, and they could be as small as, like you said, the sun shining. And then, how did you know that? Well, you stepped outside. Okay, well, you did that good. So, and don't beat yourself up. It's like, well, that's the only thing I did good, and
That's
okay,
right. Yeah,
well,
you
it's
do.
a
Yeah.
thing,
Don't let
you know.
yourself go down that trail. Because so the other, I'll say one other thing about this, because I think it touches on what you were just getting at, is a lot of times, like, there's only one appropriate emotional response to a situation. Like, you lose somebody, the appropriate response is sadness and grief. Like, and it's normal, and we should feel bad, right? There's a lot of other situations where there's multiple appropriate emotional responses, and sometimes it might be like anger or humor. Right? Like, that's actually a pretty common situation where you could be really pissed off, or you could laugh because somebody's a jackass. Right? And the truth is, in those situations where we get to choose, we have a lot of power over our experience because you can have a day where you laughed at people and kind of had a good time, or you can have a day where you were ticked off the whole day.
Right.
And you don't always get that choice, but sometimes you do.
So, even something as small as just making that choice to laugh instead of getting angry or something like, hey, you know what? Be grateful that at least you weren't angry for that short
That's
piece of
right.
the day, you know, which
Yeah.
probably would have made you angry for the rest of the day as well,
There you
right?
go.
So,
That's right.
for the listeners who might be interested in some of the services that you have to offer, you know, if there's anyone out there who provides services to other people who may have had some sort of trauma in their lives, can they, is there a place that they can go to find out more about the programs that you offer and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So, just for trauma informed, the organization, just the website is a great place to find us. It's Trauma Policy, so TraumaPolicy.org.
Okay.
And then to find all to connect with me and see some of the other things I'm working on is at marklobryan.com.
Excellent. Excellent. And I'll put links to those in the show notes for the listeners to check it out and you know, find out a little bit more information, you know, and hopefully can help some folks along the way. But Mark, it's been great chatting with you. You know, kind of opened my eyes to, you know, your experience and kind of what you had to go through. And but also, you know, the work that you're doing and the other folks who might be out there suffering from trauma who are getting the benefit of the services that you're providing to those other providers. It's kind of like a force multiplier where you go out and you spread this information out to those other people and they're able to take it and hopefully impact their area of influence a little bit better. So, thank you again for taking the time to come on the show. Really do appreciate it and appreciate you taking the time to share your story.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott. It's been a real pleasure. And that's one of my three blessings for the day. So I can be grateful for a good time with you. Thanks, Scott.
Absolutely. Likewise. Thank you.